Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to a new series called The Artifact. In this series, I shall be speaking to some of Malta's key archaeologists about archaeology in general and about the many fascinating projects that are in progress or planned for the future. Today's guest is Dr. Timmy Gambin. Dr. Gambin is a maritime archaeologist whose main research interests are maritime landscapes, archaeology of coastal changes, as well as Roman economy and trade in the central Mediterranean. After gaining a BA in history, Dr. Gambin went on to read for a master's in maritime archaeology and history, which he followed up with an MLit in archaeology and PhD from the University of Bristol. His thesis was concerned with the maritime landscapes of Malta from the Roman period to the Middle Ages. Currently, he's working as a heritage consultant, but is also a part-time lecturer at the University of Malta and has been responsible for the conceptualization and formulation of the first undergraduate course in maritime archaeology and history. Welcome, Dr. Gambin. Well, perhaps we ought to start off, really, the discussion today with perhaps a bit of a definition of maritime or underwater archaeology.
Yes, first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in this programme. Absolutely, I think it's essential to start off with definitions because there's often a lot of misunderstanding between the various terminologies used. You'll often hear people speaking of maritime archaeology, marine archaeology, underwater archaeology, and even nautical archaeology. That's four terminologies or four terms used sometimes to describe the same activity. I wouldn't say it's either or, but they all coexist. I'll give you an example. Considering underwater archaeology or archaeology done underwater, it could consist of something that has absolutely nothing to do with maritime activity, such as a Roman villa, which due to an earthquake or some other factor has ended up underwater, but it essentially has nothing to do with shipping or trade. On the other hand, we have maritime archaeology, which is concerned with the material remains related to trade and shipping and other activities at sea, and yet some of the remains from such activity can even be found in terrestrial contexts. And at this point, your listeners might be asking, but how could this be? The answer to this is that some areas which were once out at sea are now dry land. So there may be areas which have port structures, such as breakwaters or quays, which are now under meters of sediment, or there are even shipwrecks which have been found in what we call dry contexts. And examples of these are, we have plenty, especially from Italy recently, in Naples and also in Pisa. So when one speaks of maritime archaeology, one deals specifically with remains, with material remains related to ships and seafaring. When one deals with archaeology underwater or underwater archaeology, the subject or the content can be much broader. One can be dealing with Neolithic remains that may be underwater, structural remains, one can be dealing with a shipwreck. Just to give you another example, in Central America, there are these underwater caverns, which are very much landlocked in the jungles of Central America, and these were considered by the ancient people, such as the Aztecs, as holy sites, and they would throw offerings and sometimes even human sacrifices into these pools of water. Somebody studying these remains today is carrying out underwater archaeology, but it can't be far removed from the sea than a landlocked jungle site. So although it's underwater archaeology, it's got nothing to do with the sea.
And I can think of another example of perhaps examination of boat situations where they're part of funereal context. I mean, the boats that are the famous ones of Oslo, where they were found actually in barrows and that sort of thing. So you're going to be looking at a nautical situation, but definitely not a sea situation.
We have a similar example from the excavation at Sutton Hoo in the UK, where a seagoing vessel was dragged from a river to a terrestrial site to bury a rich Saxon king. The burial site is very much a terrestrial in a terrestrial context. However, the information on early medieval Saxon boat building, which one has from the Sutton Hoo burial, is indispensable. So we have information on material evidence for ships and shipping from what we can deem to be a terrestrial site. So there is a lot of overlap, and it's important that one sort of doesn't stick with one definition and one doesn't limit oneself to one aspect of this very vast subject.
Mm-hmm. Just for those listeners who might have just joined us, this is The Artifact, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking to Dr. Timothy Gambin on the subject of maritime archaeology. Perhaps we could take a glance at the development of maritime excavation. I mean, how far does it go back as a discipline?
Well, the discipline of diving is recorded way back in Greek and definitely in Roman times. They were the people referred to as urinatores, and these were specifically engaged in diving with free breath diving, specifically engaged to recover objects from the seabed. So if any objects were lost overboard, they would engage these divers to retrieve things like amphoras and other objects that may have been lost. Then we have other recordings of divers retrieving objects. Even after the loss of the Mary Rose, there were Venetian divers who were contracted to recover the precious objects, like a bronze cannon, for example. However, the real breakthrough happened towards the middle of the last century, just after the Second World War, where French people, amongst whom Jacques Cousteau, were experimenting with scuba equipment, and scuba stands for the uninitiated, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, and the development of the aqualung. Basically, it's a container which holds compressed air and a series of valves which allow the diver to breathe air on demand. The invention of this system and its very rapid evolution from something very rudimentary and basic to something which is available today off the shelf literally opened the doors to the exploration of underwater sites and other related subjects. Just to give you a small example, prior to the invention of the aqualung and subsequent exploration of underwater sites, especially shipwrecks, our knowledge of amphora studies, the studies of these old ceramic containers, which were used to transport things like oil and wine throughout the ancient world, was somewhat limited. Why? Because we depended solely on terrestrial sites and fragments, because in a terrestrial context, the reality is that many objects would get broken. There are some rare occasions when mm-hmm. whole ones are found, but we were limited solely to terrestrial sites. When archaeologists started exploring whole amphora sites underwater, various branches of amphora studies started to take off. Things like the study of different typologies, variations of different types of amphoras, but also more specific studies such as the stamps and the writings on the amphoras themselves. These stamps and writings shed vital information on the people that made the amphoras, on the people that, on the contents of the amphoras, where they were made, and obviously the wrecks themselves give us a very clear idea of the routes that ships took to deliver these amphoras, and also where the produce was going. So from very humble beginnings in France during the Second World War, these people that invented the scuba system have opened up a whole new world to us archaeologists.
Mm. A lot of the underwater archaeology that the usual listener to the radio or television viewer gets to hear about are the famous wrecks. And I think at this point, perhaps one ought to mention something about the ethics of underwater archaeology. I mean, this is a bit of a thorny subject, I think.
Mm. You're absolutely right. It's always I don't know, the deepest wreck or the oldest wreck or the richest wreck, which makes the headlines.
Makes the headlines, quite.
However, it is absolutely fundamental to stress the point that even the smallest object has a story to tell. And once that object is removed from its context, or once that object is moved and not studied by professional archaeologists, we lose a great deal of that story, a great part of that story. Local legislation emphasizes and does cater for the discovery of objects underwater. Anybody discovering old objects, and the new legislation defines old objects anything over 50 years, mm-hmm. is explicitly instructed to leave the object where they have found it, take a bearing, so try and note certain features which would help them return to the site, and report the object to the Superintendent of Cultural Heritage. The Superintendent of Cultural Heritage will take the necessary steps to record the object in situ and, if necessary, to recover it. And then, after recovery, because when one removes an object from its underwater context, that is not the end of the story. There is a whole process related to the conservation of this object. Why? Because in many cases, when an object is in situ underwater, it is protected by the very environment that surrounds it. Once this is removed and the object comes into contact with air, the object starts to deteriorate. So what may seem as a conversation piece or as a trophy from the deep to a normal diver will end up as something which is deteriorating on his mantelpiece, probably the cause of marital distress, because his wife will be asking him to remove it as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. We've had cases where things, very, very similar cases, and these objects would be removed to a garage only to be forgotten. But even more importantly, these people will be removing evidence, will be removing part of the history, not of my history or of your history, but of the history of our island.
Sure. Recently, I saw something on a news item on the television where they were talking about the opening of an underwater museum somewhere in the Mediterranean. I forget exactly where it was. You might be able to enlighten me. How possible is that, really?
It's very possible, and really and truly, it's the way forward. Why? Because with underwater objects, the philosophy is now to take the visitor to the site rather than take the site away from its surroundings and take it to a museum. There are many difficulties that one has to consider, like looting, because I can state here that most divers, the vast majority of divers, are genuine and will report objects, but you do get the one or two, the odd one out that may be tempted to remove a piece. I'm not only talking locally. I'll give you an example. When a similar underwater museum was opened in Spain, they actually put down false amphoras, and some diver even tried to remove these from the site. They could not keep their fingers off them. Yeah. I've mentioned one in Spain. This is part of the ancient harbor of Ampurias, which is open to the public. But there are others. There's one which they've opened recently in Italy, in Bahia near Naples, which is a submerged town. Very successfully, they actually managed to remove a commercial harbour from on top of this site and open it to the public. At the moment, it's only open to snorkelers because of the very delicate nature of the site. There are many mosaics which one can visit underwater and so on. What is the possibility locally? The probability, rather, is to open, rather than an ancient site, the probability is to open either a World War I or a World War II site, get the persons involved around the table to discuss what the ethics are, things like aspects such as war graves and so on. It's possible, And let's hope that it becomes a reality in the near to medium future.
Mm-hmm. What about maritime archaeology specifically in Malta? I mean, how far have we got along that road, really?
Just like archaeology in general in the 50s and 60s, we were to a certain extent dependent on foreign scholars or foreign teams visiting the island. This is even more true, or especially true, with regard to work underwater. Why? Because in the early 60s, the scuba equipment, which I mentioned earlier, was still being developed and was not commonly available. Neither was the training to become a scuba diver readily available. So one had a handful of Maltese divers who used to genuinely pick up objects and hand them over to the museum's department, which was not very different to what was happening elsewhere in the early 1960s, one has to stress. And on the other hand, you had visiting groups of mainly English divers, clubs related to services such as the Royal Air Force, who would use Malta as a training camp for scuba diving. They would also try and relate these training camps with work-related experiences. So it would either be a marine biology survey or a survey of caves, and sometimes they would work on underwater archaeology. One of the most famous cases is the site at Schlendi, which was, I wouldn't say it was an excavation, but it was a recovery project whereby they mapped the topography of the area and they recovered objects and handed them over to the museum's department, which now, these objects now form part of what I believe is one of the most homogeneous displays in our museums.
It's
related to underwater,
yes,
to underwater
sites. If anyone
sites.
Hasn't been to see it, they really should.
And the objects are housed in the Museum of Archaeology in the Citadel in Gozo. In the late 1960s, we were actually very lucky to have a visit by Miss Honor Frost, who was at the time a leading underwater archaeologist. She remained a pioneer in the sphere for and remains a pioneer till today. The lady still publishes a lot of work, especially on her work especially on her projects in Lebanon. She was on her way to the Middle East, but due to problems arising from an outbreak of war, she stopped in Malta and carried out an underwater excavation. This was, I believe, the first proper scientific underwater excavation on the island. And she excavated part of a second century Roman wreck. It was an excavation in difficult circumstances, but we were lucky that she had visited and excavated on our island. There was a little bit of a break in the 1970s and also in early 1980s. And then from the mid-1980s onwards, we had a number of foreign institutions, like Institute of Nautical Archaeology, Special Archaeological Services, who came to the island and carried out surveys. But it was always a bit of stop and start. These institutions would come, spend the season working, then leave, not come back, or perhaps not even publish the findings. In some severe cases, even keeping the data for themselves. So one a natural reaction to that would be the next person that comes along to apply for a permit.
You tell them no, thank you.
Thanks, but no thanks. You know, the objects are protected as they are. However, recently we have had a breakthrough. Since 2001, there have been a variety of projects, mainly the institutions of the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage, the University of Malta, and now also Heritage Malta, working in conjunction on a variety of projects, some of them funded by the EU, like La Navigation de Savoie, which was managed by the Mediterranean Institute. This consisted of a number of field schools in underwater archaeology, whereby two or three local archaeologists were trained. And we went to work on projects in France, three two local participants actually worked on a project in Algeria. We carried out an excavation in Malta on the ambit of this project. We probably, through the university, we also participated in the ANSER project, whereby we had an opportunity to work in Spain. We also had funding to create a database of shipwrecks in our local waters. This was done in conjunction with Heritage Malta and the superintendent. So now the superintendents have this database, which can go towards the National Infantry. So things have been coming together. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has really played a crucial role is locally trained people. Besides myself, there are two or three other archaeologists who work in the field. And this is essential because it has given us a degree of continuity.
Sure.
So something started last year, mm-hmm. can either be wrapped up or continued. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, coincidentally, that was started last year, working very closely with the superintendents, was the beginning of the creation of a digital map of our underwater sites. This is a first, not only for Malta, but also internationally. I can state that in Italy they have started the same process, so we can say that we're on par with other European Mediterranean countries. This map consists of a GIS, georeferenced digital map, which has a terrain model of the seabed, but also all the specific sites. It is a medium to long-term project. We covered quite a large stretch last year, and the plans are to continue with this season, in this mm-hmm. summer, to cover the next part. And finally, there are other projects in the pipeline related to EU-funded projects and tying these in with this ongoing project, for example, of the mapping, one of which is to try and recreate the past environment of the Roman port at Marsa.
Mm. Yes, exactly. I'm not a water baby myself, so not my area, but I was fascinated to hear you talk and to see you at work in the Grand Harbour. When the new wharf was being created, you and your colleagues had done some investigative archaeology and had actually brought up some very interesting pieces. But again, there you had conservation problems. Then where are you going to put them and all the rest of it? How's that going?
That's going well. The next phase is to publish the scientific publication. We published in a local journal, so I'm a firm believer in sharing this kind of information with the general public. It's no use, to have the scientists excavating and sort of keeping all the information for themselves. Mm. So the first step was to publish in a local journal, and that has happened. That was published in 2003. The next step is to publish, to have the scientific publication, so that people researching in similar conditions can, in similar circumstances, can reference our work. It's taking a lot of time because there is such a diversity of finds from such mm-hmm. a small excavation that we're needing to rope in various experts,
and
it's taking a bit longer than expected, mm-hmm. but it is in hand. And the other thing about that particular site is there is so much archaeology and so much important archaeology that it is well protected by the many meters of sediment that is in mm-hmm. that is in the bay. And it is one thing when the layman says,
mm-hmm.
The reality is that mm-hmm. at this point in time, with our resources, we would be doing a better service to future generations if we leave them preserved. They are not deteriorating. No. They are very well preserved. We would be doing a better service to our nation and our heritage if we leave them there for future generations, which may come in 10, 20 or 30 years' time, that may have better knowledge or better resources to explore such sites.
Well, as usual, time has run out on us. This is the end of today's programme. I'd like to thank Dr. Gambin for being with us and talking to us about the wonderful world of underwater archaeology. Until next time, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.